Well, hello everybody, it's Bikescape, episode number 63, June 29th, 2008. Hey, welcome everybody to another Bikescape, and this is another in a series of podcasts about the Towards Car Free Cities conference that just finished in Portland about a week ago. It was an amazing conference, and it ended on Sunday with a 6-mile car free streets area going through Portland. It was called Sunday Parkways, and it was modeled after the ciclovias that have happened down in Bogota for years and years now, Bogota, Colombia. And the person who started those ciclovias, who inspired this thing in Portland, and it's actually going to be happening in New York and San Francisco and probably some other cities, maybe closer to where you live in the future. We'll be covering that in the future here on Bikescape. But it was all inspired by Gil Peñalosa, who was at the time the Commissioner of Parks, Sports, and Recreation down in Bogota, Colombia. His brother soon became the mayor based on some of the things, some of the programs that they initiated. And there they closed 91 kilometers of car-free streets, opened it up, closed it to cars, but they opened it up to everybody else. And it, all through the streets of Bogota, it became this wonderful transformed public space that opened everything up to recreation and exercise and fresh air and turns the streets into a playground for 1.5 million people every week. Every Sunday, 1.5 million people come out and they skate and dance and stroll around on the streets. Anyway, Gil was in town. He gave the keynote speech. Here's the recording. And following that, there is a recording also of the press conference that I got to participate in, along with Steve Jones from The Bay Guardian and Jonathan Moss from Bike Portland and quite a few other people, reporters that were there on the scene. So, enjoy.
Thank you very much, Mia. I think this is fantastic. Being here in Portland, such a wonderful city, and going after, the only thing that going after Mia and Andy is tough. And actually, you know, I was going to start today talking about this, because, you know,
he can't hear you.
Be more philosophical about
birds.
Hello. Okay. How birds need to fly, and fish need to swim, and pedestrians need to walk, and cyclists need to bike for life. You know, we have learned to survive, but now we really have to learn how to live, and this is something. But then I had all of this prepared, and I was going to be very inspirational about this. And actually, we made some stickers if anybody wants any for free, they can grab them afterwards. But then this morning, I looked at the New York Times, a this morning, and wow, I saw Mayor Bloomberg and our friend Lance. And what were they doing? They were announcing that in August they're going to have a 3-day Manhattan free of cars. That is fantastic. You know, and actually, one of the things that they're going to go all the way from Central Park down to the Brooklyn Bridge. Park Avenue, it's going to be fantastic. One of the things the Commissioner Janet Sadik said is the idea was to make the streets a heaven for walkers, cyclists, and others. I think this is really, really fantastic, you know? And actually, Portland has a lot to do with it, because in New York, they were thinking about it. We talked about it 2 years ago, a year ago, and when they said, you know, Portland is doing it, and Baltimore is around the corner, and Chicago is doing it, then New York said, oh, we got to do it ahead of them. So this is such a healthy competition that I wish. So I'm very, very happy for the people of New York. And also because all of this, you know, one of the things that is fantastic about this is that different from when you're in the private sector, like if you're selling shampoo X and you're going to sell one more dollar, then shampoo Y has to sell one less dollar. But in this, if New York is very successful with their Sunday bikeways, that's good for everybody else. That isn't bad for anybody. So if Portland does well, fantastic. If New York does good, if Madison, if Lexington, if Houston, if whoever does good, it's good for everybody, you know? It's no one, the fact that any city is doing well, that is not against any other. So I think this was fantastic. I just want to show, because it's from today's New York Times, and it's a great story. And actually, you know, the other day I was flying in Air Canada, and I saw in the cover story of the magazine of Air Canada, it said, do you live in a happy city? The cities are undergoing a radical change with one thing in mind, your well-being. And it's really, really nice. And actually, in the cover story had a few things, and it says, from Paris to Bogota. Well, so I'm going to talk a little bit about Paris, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Bogota. And it says that the more we meet outside of our cars, the kinder and gentler we are likely to become. And it is true. I think, you know, life is at a different rhythm when you're walking or cycling. So I think that's why all of this is important. And now, actually, you know, it seems like everybody wants to bike. Whether it's Elle Macpherson or Kate Blanchett or other people that need now a multi person bike, Brad Pitt and Angelina. But for the women, so that women don't think that every man cycling looks like Pee-wee, you know, Dr. McGrimmie. He also bikes, and actually he's a nice dad. You know, he's teaching his daughter how to bike, which is quite nice. But women also, not only Dr. McGrimmie, you know, women, you know, it's long past the time when women were vacuuming. Now they go out and cycle with their Louis Vuitton purses. you know, it's totally different. This is what we need. We need to make this fashionable, you know? And also they can match in colors, you know? So all of this is nice and fun. And this is New York City the other day they had a fashion show. So it's very, very true that people are thinking and talking bicycles and also walkable communities. But thinking and talking bicycles, but not doing enough. There is no doubt that we are not doing enough. And like someone else that everyone knows used to say, you know, life is like a bicycle. To keep your balance, you must keep moving. And we gotta keep moving. So how to move from thinking and talking to doing? That's what this conference is about. So what kind of cities are we going to build? You know, the U.S. population only 2 years ago reached 300 million. In 2043, it's going to reach 400 million. And this is according to the U.S. Census Bureau. You go to their website. So that means that there's going to be 100 million additional people in just 35 years. That's nothing. You know, What's about 100 millimeters? A lot of people. How many is 100 millimeters? They're like the people of New York, LA, Chicago, Dallas, Miami, Washington. And then Seattle, Minneapolis, San Diego, Boulder. That's 100 million people. That's like doing all of those cities in 35 years. So as we go in any city across North America, there are many things that we say, you know, this has to be improved. This has to get better. So not only must we improve the existing cities, but we must build great cities for 100 million additional people in the next 35 years. So this is a wonderful and historic challenge, but it's also a fantastic opportunity, because never before and never after are we going to build so many communities for so many people in such a short period of time. So this also conveys a great responsibility on how are we going to build these communities. Unfortunately, most of them are not being built as they should. So we really got to get moving. So we got to think, and as I talk today, I want you to think of what kind of cities are we going to build, and especially on how do we want to live. Because, you know, some people were talking about Houston a few minutes ago, but if Houston is a model of city, we're going to build very different cities than if Copenhagen is our model of city. How do we want to live? Do we want our kids to walk to school, so then we're going to build small elementary schools so that the area of influence is small? Or do we want them to be driven to, so then we got gigantic elementary schools, so then the area of influence is huge? Do we want people to actually walk to for milk and eggs, so then we're going to have standards, even in the suburbs, that every 500 yards or whatever there has to be a corner store? So how do we want to live? I think people talk about, you know, should we have LRTs or BRTs or what kind of transit system? No, first let's have clarity. How do we want to live? Because the reality is that if we define our city around cars, then all we get is more cars. And then we gotta go and invite our friends to help us cross the street. You know, the population is getting older, and we're seeing a lot of streets that are very, very wide. And actually, this is the only overpass we've ever built that actually reduces traffic. When we define cities around people, then we get more people, and healthier and happier people. And we get also healthier communities and better quality of life. A better quality of life for all. And actually, when people say about quality of life, the other day a U.S. politician said, oh, Gil, you know, we cannot talk about quality of life because we have an economic problem. You know, there's a depression around the corner, so we cannot waste resources on quality of life. Well, it didn't make a lot of sense to me either. But, you know, in an ever more globalized world, the best people, whether it's the best carpenters or artists or medical doctors or engineers, they can live anywhere in the world. So why would they live in Portland and not in Seattle or New York or Copenhagen or Sao Paulo or whatever? The other day I met a professor from a university, another Texas example, but I don't want to lie, it's a professor from the University of Texas. And he got an offer for another job at another university in a different state, and he was getting 10% more salary. And he didn't even think about it. He said, oh, no, Gil, I didn't think about it. You know, I'm happy living here in Texas. And then he got another offer for 12% more salary. Again, he didn't think about it. But then he got an offer to work in Portland with the same salary, not 1 cent increase. And he was thinking about it. You know, that's the magic of having great cities, that people, the best people, want to live there. The best carpenters and the best artists, the best engineers. So that's why this is about economic survival. Remember Detroit. Detroit 40 years ago had 2 million people. Today has 900,000 people. So people leave. And some people are simplistic and say people left Detroit is because of the weather. No, you know, Minneapolis is next door. I mean, Minneapolis is colder and it's a fantastic city that is growing. Is doing very well from the economic point of view. So you know, this is about economic competitiveness, the quality of life. So how to attract and retain the highly creative and educated people is the challenge of any city. And I think that's one of the things that Portland is doing nice, and I think that's one of the reasons why it got the award today. And a good city is not just a matter of engineering. It's much more akin to art. So, I'm very happy that I was invited to speak today with you, to share some time with you. and rethinking mobility and rediscovering proximity. But obviously, I knew I was going to talk after Andy, and he was going to give you an award, so I want to congratulate Portland. Portland have done a lot of good things. Look at the bicycle network in 1990, 95, 2000, 2005. So they're doing a lot of nice things. Increasing the bicycle use. This is the cyclist per day at one of the bridges. Look how it's growing. So I think it's really nice. This is in 92, 2,800 daily trips. In 2005, over 10,000. Now it's around 12,000. So a lot of good things. The decrease in crash rate. Mia was talking about the more cyclists, you know, safety in numbers, the more cyclists, then the safer that it becomes. And it's quite nice how this the index of accidents have decreased. But, you know, it wasn't overnight. Look at this. This was done in 92. So it's year after year after year doing a lot of things, little things, big things. Unfortunately, it's not one big thing that creates a great city. It's thousands and thousands of little ones. This is one of the things that I like the most is Portland's boulevards and how they are reducing traffic. Because I do think that, and I'm going to talk about the bike lanes in a minute, and Andy, I'm not fundamentalist, but I do think that in the arterials, you need safe facilities. But you also need, in the non-arterials, these bike boulevards, which are fantastic. And you can also have bike lanes, and you can also have road diets and whatever. So I think that in Portland, you have used a lot of really good tools, and the mix of those tools is what's clicking. Even parking, you know. Cyclists and pedestrians must be best friends. Best friends. So you gotta get the bicycles off the sidewalk, because when you put the bikes on the sidewalk, they park on the sidewalk. Get one car space and you can put 15 bikes in there. So are you going to bother one car driver or are you going to bother all the pedestrians and get people in conflict? So really we got to work as best friends. And this is also something that is really, really nice. You know. But, so I already said so many wonderful things about Portland, but I want to also have a warning. Because, you know, something that is really hard, and some of you have read the book From Good to Great, sometimes it's really, really hard to go from good to great. Sometimes it's easier to go from bad to great. Because when you are bad, you are willing to take more risk, and you are willing to try different things. When you are good, you become complacent. And sometimes it's harder to convince people. And the reality is that Portland is far from being great. You have to realize that. I wish the league would have an award that no one ever got. You know, it reminded me like you know, they used to have these dog races of dogs, and they used to have like a rabbit in front of the dogs, and an electronic rabbit that the dogs would never catch. That's why we need an award like that, so that you can always strike. You know, it has to be a process of continuous improvement. You always need to improve. But if they told you you're already the best, then what do you do next? So let's take a look. Who's writing today? You know, 2 out of 3 people are men. That isn't good. You know, most of the cities where you got 10, 15, 20, 30% of the people writing, always half of them are women, and usually more than half are women. More than 2 out of 3 are people 25 to 50. So there is a lot of room for improvement. You know, and this is the bike share, you know. The reality is that there is not even one area where it's over 10%. And most of it is around 5 or less. So although it's fantastic compared to the U.S. or Canadian standards, it's really not good in the world stage. So these are some of the things that we have to realize. One of the nice things about Portland is that Portland is very creative and they're already thinking about it. And this is done by Portland. And they realize that there is about 1% of the kamikaze cyclists. And I think most of us in this room are part of those kamikaze cyclists that we bike anywhere. We don't need anything. We don't need the bike lanes or the cycle or whatever. Any city we go, we bike. But that's only 1%. So are we going to build facilities for that 1%? Then there is about a third of the people that they will not bike. no way, no how. It doesn't matter. You can have the Rolls Royce of bikeways, and they will not use it. But then here's about another 10% who are enthusiastic and confident if you put some minimum standards. But the majority of the people are interested but concerned. So who is our target segment? How do we want? Who do we want cycling in our city? And I think this is the challenge that Portland is facing right now. Is how to get that people, the interested but concerned. So I think that Portland is in a fantastic place because Portland has the possibility to really become a world-class cycling city. But in order to become a world-class cycling city, it needs more children, more women, and more older adults cycling. There's absolutely no doubt. And also, because actually the quality of any city, in any city in general, not only cycling or walking, but any city in general, the perfect indicator, like the accountants say, the acid test. The acid test of a great city is how they treat the children and their older adults. Same thing with the acid test for pedestrians or for cyclists. So where does Portland want to play? Does Portland want to play with the heavyweights or with the lightweights? Portland is almost like the champion of the NCAA. So does Portland want to stay in the NCAA forever? Or does Portland want to go and play in the Nadal's and Federer's area, in their courts? So which court does Portland want to play? Because right now it's playing here. But it would be great if it could play here. Where does Portland want to play? Does Portland want to stay as champion of the Little League soccer across North America? Or does Portland want to be world champion? World champion. And I think that's the possibility that Portland has. Portland, it would be fantastic. If Portland says, okay, thanks, Andy, we appreciate the award, but now we're in a different league. So now we're not going to be benchmarking ourselves with the Houston and Lexingtons and Atlantas and Buffaloes and whatever of the world. Honestly, we're going to be realistic. And they also have to be realistic that they got to move to bronze and then gold and then whatever. So Portland has to be in the rank with the Copenhagens and Vancouver's and Melbourne's and Paris and Amsterdam and Barcelona and Berlin. That's where Portland belongs, and that's the challenge. And this would be fantastic if we could have a city in North America with 20-30% bike share and another 30% pedestrian share. That would be great for everybody. For everybody. I don't think that there could be anything better, because we would not be showing examples of Copenhagen or of Paris or Berlin, but we will be showing Portland everywhere. So all of us, and honestly, when I say this, I don't want you to take it personal when I criticize a little bit and I tell you that you are only good. You are far from being great. It's the reality. But it's because we would love, everybody would love Portland to be great, because that would raise the bar to everybody, and that would provide a fantastic example to follow. So your success will benefit everybody. So I wish you all the very best. But then let's go back to my topic today, because I think that we gotta go beyond the baby steps. When I say perfect storm, perfect opportunity, it's because, I want to talk a little bit about why I think it's a perfect storm, why it's a perfect opportunity, and what does it mean to go beyond the baby steps. So first, why is it a perfect storm? Well, Andy mentioned a few things, but the reality is that we got a major, major problem. If 20 years ago, we would have thought, what would be the ideal condition to promote walking and cycling anywhere in the world? Well, everything is taking place now, unfortunately. But nevertheless, we're not moving fast enough. And sometimes some cities do a little bit of they paint a line here, they do this there, finally we got it. No, that's not enough. Under the existing conditions, we have to make major leaps, not baby steps. And every condition, let me show you a few of the conditions. With the environment, There is no doubt, and Al Gore was helpful because a few years ago, people were still saying that there wasn't any global warming, that that was just some creation of the scientists. The oil is going to be more and more expensive all the time, also. There is no doubt about it. And if we were going to transport a group of people, of 60 people, we could either walk, or we could take 60 cars, or we could take one bus, or we could take 60 bikes. So there is no doubt that pedestrians, cyclists, buses take up a lot less space. You know, but some people are saying, you know, oh, I don't care. I still want to use my car, and if the oil price goes up, then we got to find a different way to make gas and not out of oil. And I saw this the other day on a newspaper in Latin America that I said, don't even think of touching my food. You know, an idea that initially sounded nice, you know, having oil, energy out of food, is going terribly wrong, you know. Actually, look at this, and this is not leftist Fidel Castro saying it. While many are worrying about filling their gas tanks, others around the world are struggling to fill their stomachs. And it is getting much more difficult every day. That's the president of the World Bank. So, you know, extreme right, and he's realizing what a terrible thing is. And then also we got the environment, and so many environmental issues, you know, and look at how are we going to dispose of those tires. So there is no doubt. You know, the energy used in private cars. This is in Texas. It's Georgia. So here's New York, here's Atlanta, here in the bottom. And daily trips, walking and cycling. And if you were memorizing what the other graph looked like, this is not what it is. You don't have to read. So it's very clear what is happening. Also, safety. Safety is a major, major problem. You know, people don't talk about it. But if there was a plane accident every day, you know, one yesterday, another one today, another one tomorrow in the U.S., and 13 people were killed and 274 were injured, could you imagine? That would be the biggest scandal ever. Something would be done about it. Well, every day in the U.S., 13 pedestrians are killed, 274 are injured, in addition to 2 cyclists and 123 cyclists. You know, in the U.S., over 100,000 pedestrians are injured every year. Every year. You know, in the U.S., there are more pedestrians killed every year than people have been killed, than U.S. citizens have been killed in Iraq since the war started. But this is not even almost a topic of conversation. This is almost a given. This is crazy, you know. And actually, the other day, someone told me, hey, Gil, you know what? That's why I don't walk and I don't bike. Because it's dangerous. And then I said, you know, that reminds me of a friend that when he went home, he found his wife with another guy in their couch. So then he sold the couch. But there is no need to sell the couch, because what is dangerous is not walking or cycling. Look at this. This is in Europe. There's a lot more bike travel. Look at here we got Australia, U.S., Canada on this side, and we got Finland, Denmark, Netherlands, and far fewer deaths. And that's cycling. And if we include walking, the trend is exactly the same. Far fewer people, far fewer proportion of trips, and many, many more deaths. So we really need, that's why we need facilities, and that's why we need education, and that's why we need promotion. And health, you know, the shape of things to come. You know, is this what our future looks like? So this is a perfect storm, you know, and the lack of physical activity, I mean, there are many, many problems with lack of physical activity. You know, this is the physical activity in the U.S. since 1990. It's flat. It's not increasing. Despite all of this overwhelming evidence. You know, this is obesity of women in the Americas. That's the U.S. So, this is the obesity rates and the publications, you know. Obesity is growing, the publications are growing. But the levels of physical activity is not moving at all. Maybe with their thumbs, writing the articles. You know, and when people tell you, you know, it's like global warming, people say, oh, it's always been like that. Obesity, people always say, oh, it's always been like that. This is data from CDC in Atlanta. You know, in 1985, there were very few states that even had more than 10% obesity rates. This is not overweight. This is obesity that on average is about 30 pounds more than overweight. 1990, 95, now there's like over 15%. 2000, now we got over 20%. So 2004, 2005. Now there are some states that more than one in three are obese, not overweight, obese. Can you imagine the fantastic park systems, the fantastic bike? We could fund all of the bikeway systems just with a small portion of the savings of the health system if we didn't have to spend so much money in health due to the obesity crisis. You know? So, and look at this. What is the percentage of diseases attributed? Physical inactivity. Worse than everything except tobacco. You know, actually, this was in the year 1700. In the 1700, this is a historical. The physical activity, a lot of people used to do physical activity because of work, a little bit domestic, transportation, and very little recreation. And now, this is today. And actually, this is a developing nation, is a little bit behind the U.S. But this is the U.S. And look, recreational physical activity has increased a little bit. Transportation is decreased substantially. Look at this. Domestic and work. It's incredible. And then what does this walking and cycling have to do? Because, you know, the countries that have a lot of walking and cycling have a lot less obesity rates. You know, this is a chart by our friend John Pusher from Rutgers, that the percentage of people walking, cycling, or taking transit, the higher the percentage, the lower the obesity rates. So it's very clear. This is the modal travel in urban areas of Netherlands, Germany, England, and Canada, and the U.S. That is going to be U.S. Portland less, because now Portland is going to compete in the other league. Look at the obesity rates. This is incredible. You know, and we're going to have to take different measures. You know, the UK, on this chart, is the second worst after the US. And then the UK is starting to do some more aggressive advertising campaigns. And actually, I saw this campaign the other day from the British Heart Foundation. Get your 30 minutes a day anyway. I mean, we got to do things differently if we want to have different results. And in transportation, you know, there are a lot of problematic symptoms. People are driving to the gym to walk on a treadmill. When this happens, it's because people do not live in a very walkable neighborhood. But there are also more problematic symptoms, such as this one. 24 hours. Not one is walking out. And you know, and this is from a Canadian city. You know, how is people really? We cannot provide transit systems that are only for people that do not have any other option, you know. It's not even a bus shelter. This is in front of a school of 1,300 students, you know. So these are the kind of things. And then we have this. Ooh, yeah. This is from our friend from PPS. And someone said, why do you have that there? And I said, well, because maybe that's what the bus shelters might look like if the decision makers use the bus service. So that's why we need mayors and governors and senators and presidents that ride bikes, that walk, whatever, because things change. But now let's go to the other side of the equation. So it's very clear why it is. Cycling, we gotta move from something, we gotta reposition. Too many people still see us as some crazy nuts. That, you know, it's fun and games. You know, that's nice if there is budget after we take care of the essential services. We gotta reposition and say, you know, pedestrian and cycling issues is part of an essential services. It is part of the solution. And we have not done a good enough job. You know, the reality is that everyone in this room, we gotta really, you know, think and meditate. What's going on? What do I have to do? You know, Jessica Roberts from Alta Planning, the other day she was saying that she tells people to write to in the newspapers, write to the politicians, write everywhere. She says, if you don't write, someone else is doing the writing and is setting the policy. So we really gotta do, you know, we gotta reposition it, and it takes a lot of work. And also walking and cycling is good for the economic development, such as in Minneapolis, where they got all of these fantastic trails. But we also gotta become good at selling the ideas. When I ask the people in parks in Minneapolis, you know, how much money do they make on their trails? They said, oh, nothing. Because, you know, we don't charge anything. And I said, what do you mean you don't charge anything? You get, how many people you get on the trail? They say about 14 million per year. I said, well, what happens if each one of them has one soft drink and one hot dog? $4 times 14 and a half million, that's $58 million. You got 10% sales tax, then you got $5.8 million in sales tax. What happens if 10% of them stayed overnight and so on? So we have to become really good with the numbers. And that's one of the things important as well, get the numbers right. So we got to be good at selling these things. Also, walkable and bikeable cities is good for tourism, because what is really memorable and what gives character to cities are the public places. So, and also from the point of view of recreation, there is a very clear trend from east to west, north to south. People are moving away from organized activities to unorganized and unscheduled, except for soccer. People are walking, people are cycling, even like these cycling friends. Look at these guys. That's what people are doing, you know. They don't want to go on and play, shoot the hoops. And the nice thing is that this is about for all ages and genders and economic situations and all kinds of weather, so it's quite nice. But there is a myth that car-friendly cities will not change. And that's why we like Portland. Portland is showing that it can change. This was in 1990. Then in their transportation master plan, they created the vision of bikes everywhere, and it changed. Can you imagine if Portland was 15 or 20 or 25% bike share? That would be such a nice example. Boulder, Colorado. In Boulder, Colorado, they created a network. And all of a sudden, they went in 10 years from 1 in 10 people riding their bike to work to twice as many, to more than 1 in 5. So people do change when they're in a facility, like Mia was explaining. You gotta build the facilities. Obviously, that is not enough. You have to go to the schools and the business and create such as the most business-friendly awards and whatever. Because part of it is education and promotion, but you need the facilities. Berlin went from less than 1% to over 10% of world trips. But obviously, they got over 500 miles of completely separate bike paths where people feel safe. And public health. I'm going to talk a little bit about public health, because public health is your best partner. When you go to any meeting with a senator or with a governor or with the mayor or the council or whatever, and you bring your medical officer on board talking about life and death, then you are taking seriously. So those are the best partners. You know, when you come to the table, you know, you gotta broaden the audience. You gotta bring the school boards. You gotta bring the public health. You gotta bring the environmentalists. It cannot be just the cyclist fanatics or the pedestrian fanatics. We need a broader coalition. Because look at this. This is really fantastic. Look at this chart. This is the levels of fitness. And the levels of fitness, you know, if people went from 0 to 2, look at how the benefit. This is the benefits of the levels of physical activity. And that was one study. But then all of a sudden, people came up with 4 different studies. And every study after study after study said the same, you know. The improvement, the benefits of physical activity is just going from non-inactive to a little bit active. Look at this. This is quite fantastic, this research. Because, you know, if you go from inactive to being active, you have a fantastic improvement on your benefits, on your health benefits. But then from being active to being an athlete, it's not that much. I mean, it's nice if people want to do it, because also maybe sometimes maybe you look better. Maybe you shape your muscles or whatever. Or maybe you feel good. You know, I ran the New York Marathon 2 years ago, and I felt fantastic running the marathon. But it wasn't really, the health benefit was not about running the marathon. The health benefit is just the little bit of activity. So that is quite fantastic, because for many, many, many years people were saying, no pain, no gain. That's totally scratched. Now is 30 minutes of moderate physical activity a day. So this is really fantastic, because then transportation offers a lot of different options, because then walking is a mode of transportation. You know, you can if you walk 15 minutes to go to work and then 15 minutes in the afternoon, you get your 30 minutes daily. Also, you don't have to do the 30 minutes at once. You can do 15 and 15. So it's really, really nice. And some people say, oh, you know, no, in the suburbs, here in Houston, everybody drives. So we don't want any bikeways. Not Houston, let's say Detroit. Or any Lexington. Or even in Portland, where people think everybody drives. Not everybody drives. Even in the wealthiest and most sprawled communities, a third of the people do not drive. Everybody under 17, 30% of the over 60, 15 of the 18 to 60. So having proper pedestrian and cycling facilities is not something nice to do. It's almost like a human right. It's the right to mobility. And it's also because cycling... Don't ever let people tell you that no one drives, that everybody drives. You know, the Beltline 20 transit system, they're investing billions, not millions, billions all across the U.S. and Canada in transit systems. You know, how much of that is going into pedestrian and cycling facilities? Because the best link, you know, there is no public transit that is going to pick you up in front of your house and drop you off in front of the place of work. So if the cities are not really walkable or bikeable, those public transit are not going to work. So that's something that is really, really nice. And we got so, and then we something that is quite nice, the concept now of complete streets. Complete streets is really simple. It's those that are designed, built, maintained, and operated, considering pedestrians, cyclists, transit, and motor vehicles. This is in Washington State. This is an incomplete street, and it became complete. You know, if you do it from the beginning, it's so much cheaper than if you gotta do it afterwards. The other day, I was with the mayor of Louisville, and we were on an arterial, six lanes, three lanes each way, and had no sidewalks. I said, you know, what happened? Where are the sidewalks? And then he said, we ran out of money. And I said, you also didn't have your priorities clear, because if you run out of money, you could have eliminated one of the car lanes and not the sidewalks. Because otherwise, to do it afterwards is really hard. You're going to take the bus there. So it makes a huge difference. So we got to do it. Many cities across the U.S. are passing laws. Chicago passed it unanimous that any new road that is reconstructed or any new one will have to be complete. So these are the kind of things. You know, this is a high school in Palo Alto, California. 1,500 students on this side. And there is not even a crosswalk, you know. No bike facilities, no pedestrian facilities. You know, it would have been so easy to have done it from the beginning. Those are the kind of things that we got to work on. And talking about Texas, there is a Texan that I like, because he says that there are times I ride in Austin and I'm afraid of cars. Imagine what the beginner cyclist must feel like. Yeah, you're right. Lance Armstrong. Second time. So, you know, I know, Andy, about the bikings. I'm not a fundamentalist. I do think we need a broad, a nice mix of things. But the reality is that on arterials, the bike lanes do not work, because the cars, they think they can park anywhere. So, and I'm going to show you a few photos. It's everywhere, you know. Bike lanes, and my friend from Minneapolis that I like very much, because they have a fantastic trail system, but they have the worst bike lane in the world, you know. The buses are going one way, the cars are coming another, and the kamikaze cyclists in the middle. You know, this is France, in Paris. Same thing, you know. The other day, in the New York Times, they had an article about someone that parked on a bike lane, in front of a hydrant. Opened the door, the cyclist was going through the cyclist in front of a truck and was killed. And the guys in this car, all they got was a traffic ticket. You know, this is crazy. It's everywhere that is happening. So it doesn't, you know, and also if all you have in between you and an SUV is a painted line on the pavement, then you're going to go on the sidewalk. And then when you go on the sidewalk, it's the pedestrian, the one that are injured. So you do need some kind of physical separation. You know, this is fantastic. You got the area for the pedestrians, for the cyclists, for the cars, and then for the traffic. You know, some kind of physical separation is absolutely necessary if we want the children and the women and the older adults to bike. You know, one of the principles is that whatever facilities we build have to be good for everybody. If you are not willing to send, you know, the discussion is very simple. Would you send your 8-year-old with the 80-year-old grandparent or great-grandparent on a bike ride? If you would, it's safe enough. If you would not, it's not safe enough. And I do think that we need a whole mix of boulevards and bike lanes and cycle tracks and trails and whatever. But at the end of the day, they have to be safe for that 8-year-old or for that 80-year-old. You know, and they're still, you know, and they got to make the decisions. You know, this is Copenhagen 2 years ago. 4-lane road, they're taking away 2 lanes of cars and making a cycle track. What is a cycle track? Someone was asking me. Basically, is that they have the sidewalk on one level, about 3 inches lower is the bicycle, and about another 3 inches lower is the cars. So then all of them go at different levels, so there is a very clear physical separation, and then people are safe, even if they're cycling in the middle of the winter. And it's not the only way to separate. There are many ways to separate, but those are that's one of the ways to separate. And actually, the other day they had some visitors. I work with Gale Architects, as Mia mentioned, and the other day we had 2 visitors, the Commissioners of Planning and the Commissioner of Transport from New York. And this is good. You got to go and learn things, you know. Actually, they went to Bogota 2 months ago to take a look at the ciclovias, the Sunday bikeways. We had been telling them a lot about this, and they flew in Friday night. They took a look at it. Saturday, we went to the bikeways. Sunday, we went to the ciclovia. Monday, they were back. And 2 months later, bingo, they are announcing that they're going to do this. Not because of Bogota, it's because all of us have to learn from everybody. Guadalajara has a fantastic Sunday program. It's called Via Recreativa, Recreational Way. And actually, we're going to set up a workshop twice a year, once in Spanish, once in English, so that anybody can go and take a look at it. So there are a lot of really good programs. Mexico City is starting one. Now Portland starting this week. New York is going to do it. All of us. So we got to learn. When they came back and 1 month later after they came, this is September of last year, the Commissioner of Transportation said, okay, we want to have, it represents the kinds of innovative ideas that we can explore to make the streets more livable. So sidewalk, a separate, physically separate for cyclists, then a buffer, and then the cars. 30 days later, they got 9th Avenue, that used to be packed with cars, and they took away 1 lane, and they did this. Then they made some connections because you gotta get the connections on the small roads, and they have this. Can you imagine? Would this be the same on a 4 or 5 lane road if it went only up to here? You know, with the cars going at 40, 50 miles per hour, but then you get this buffer and you get those, and that's very inexpensive. They did it in 30 days. Obviously, if it works, they're gonna replace those bollards with nice plants and concrete areas, and but they gotta do it fast. You know, it's action. They have to develop a sense of urgency. Obviously, there are also some really nice ones along the Hudson River. This is some in Ottawa. So there are many. But I want to conclude with a section on beyond baby steps. One of them is the ciclovia. And actually, we have a panel on Thursday afternoon that we're going to talk about the New York and Ottawa and Bogota. But for those that are going to be attending others, because there are several sessions at the same time, let me tell you, the ciclovia basically is an area where every Sunday from 7 a.m. till 2 p.m. we close some of the major roads in Bogota so that people can walk and bike. And actually, Street Films and Clarence, the producer, is here, and Aaron, we all went to Bogota, and they are fantastic. Yeah, let's give them a hand. If you go to the Street Films website, they got about 100 different videos of all kinds of things. They have one on the ciclovia, they have another one on bikes, they have one on bike lanes versus separated facilities or whatever. And we did one on the ciclovia. And you know, the nice thing about this is that you use the existing infrastructure. You know, the other day I was riding with the mayor of Guadalajara, and at the time they had gone from 12 to 21 kilometers, which was about 15 miles. Up until then, the number one physical activity in Guadalajara was a half marathon, 3,000 people, one Sunday a year. Now we were riding, and there were 140,000 people. Now it's at over 200, but it was about a year and a half ago. And I said, Mayor, you know, have you ever thought, how else could you have 140,000 people of different ages, levels of ability, doing physical activity at the same time? I said, let's assume they were going to play soccer. On a soccer field, you got 30 people, 11 on 11 plus substitutes. You would need 4,666 soccer fields. And here you got the roads. They're already there. So that's part of being also environmentally friendly, because it's how to use the facilities for other things. Like when I was commissioner in Bogota, we went from 8 miles to 56, But what's more important is that we went from 100,000 people to over 1.5 million people every Sunday of the year. And it works very well. But as Clarence and Aaron and Carla saw, because they also did some aerobics, it's not only about walking or cycling, it's about being with people. You know, on average, on the surveys, people spend 4 hours and 15 minutes on the ciclovía, but on average, they do only 50 minutes of exercise. So people run for 20 minutes, they stop, they have an orange juice, they take a nap, they run a little bit more. And this is something that is good in any North American city, a car-free day. A car-free day in Bogota is one day a year in February, where there are simply no cars. A city of 7 million people, and there are no cars allowed, which is quite nice. And I recommend that you do it in a city of any size. It can be done in a city of 50,000 or a city of 7 million people. The educational benefits is gigantic. Because, for example, even 3 weeks before, even the people that don't like it start talking about it. You know, what are you going to do about it? You know, 3 weeks from now we got the car-free day. Are you going to go to work? Are you not going to go to work? Are your kids going to go to school? Are they not going to go to school? So you get into people's homes and people's places of work, and people start thinking about what does a city without cars look like. And then the kids in elementary school, they start doing drawings about it. And the kids in high school, they start doing research papers. So this is something that would be really fantastic. Now Brussels is doing it, in Brussels in Belgium, on a Sunday, one Sunday a year. In the Bogota, it's on a Thursday in February. So, and actually we're going to see if we organize a trip or something, because this is something that is quite interesting and can be doable in any city of any size. Can you imagine if the city, wherever you come from, if one day a year, there was nothing, not one single car. That's something that is very educational, very, very educational. Especially, you know, in a city with so many social classes and differences like Latin America, the low-income citizens were really amazed to see that the car owners could be made to leave their cars and use either public transit or walk or bike. Some of the people even use horses and all kinds of things. And Guadalajara and Mexico City also have their Sunday bike wheel, which is really fantastic, and we're going to talk about it on Thursday. Paris, they used to close some of the roads in August for the Paris Blanche. And it was only in August that they brought sand, and they were going a little crazy. And they also do aerobics. Only one guy. You know, the Colombians seem to be more equal opportunity. And it's quite nice. And oh, by the way, if you're going to, I love parks, and I got hundreds of photos of park benches. But this is my favorite park bench. Because this is a park bench where you see five different groups of people doing five different activities, and no one could care less what the other four are doing. But now, the new mayor of Paris, that is doing fantastic things in the last 3 years, he is keeping some of these roads close to cars, open to people, all year round, even in the winter. In November, and it was cold, and people were using it 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. So we're going to talk about that. But let's also talk about a little bit about the built environment, because some people say, oh, walkable cities is just about sidewalks. And this is something that Project for Public Places did in New Haven, Connecticut. This used to be one of the most dangerous places in New Haven, Connecticut. If you were walking through there, you would walk as fast as possible because you didn't want to stop. And then PPS got the community together and said, okay, you know, how can we improve this? And someone said, look, there are too many cars. Why don't we take away two or three cars so that we can widen the sidewalk? And then someone else said, oh, why don't we put a bench? And someone said, why don't we put a light? And someone said, a garbage bin, and this and that, and whatever. And all of a sudden, it came from being one of the worst quarters in New Haven to one of the best ones. You know? So this is how we create human cities and walkable places. Because walking is about distance, but it's also about having a nice place to walk. People don't like to walk against blank walls or cars going really fast or whatever, you know. And, you know, this is an example. This street split a neighborhood right through the middle. You know, it was like raping the neighborhood. It's totally car-oriented. Can you imagine if you used to live in that neighborhood before and after as compared with this one? So are we building streets for cars or streets for people? And, you know, 70% of the public space in L.A. is dedicated to car mobility. And I mean, and I like L.A., I have an MBA from UCLA, and so I lived there a few years. But the reality is that 20% of the public space in Paris is dedicated to car mobility. In which city would you rather live? And you gotta visualize some of the changes, because when you visualize, then you are able to get more people on board. Otherwise, when you only have an idea, the people, the enemies of the idea, they come up with all kinds of, they make up all of these ghosts around it. So, but if you have some kind of designs, people start visualizing and get people on board. And this is really, really nice. Look at this main street. Would you rather live in a town with this main street or with this one? So these are the kind of things that gotta work. You know, raw diets. You know, it's not rocket science, all of these things. All of this is dual. This is the concept designed from a computer, and this is the reality. This is from Michael Rankin. So it's, you know, the rocket science is not this, but the rocket science is to actually do it, to get it done. I want to tell you a little bit about Bogota. Not because Bogota is perfect. It's far from perfect. But it's a city that was going down the hill, and it went from hopeless to hopeful. So I'm going to show you a few things. In Bogota, and I'm going to show you this not because I was the commissioner. And also not because after me, one of my brothers was the mayor. But because Bogota has 1/10 the per capita income of the U.S. So every time I go across the U.S., always the politicians tell me, oh, we don't have money. So I'm going to tell you that it's not an issue of money, that is an issue of priorities. Between 1995 and 2001, we built over 800 neighborhood parks. Over 50 zone and 5 metropolitan parks. Some of the metropolitan parks were this one, 360 hectares, 889 acres in the heart of the city. The boom had come in 68, nothing had been done in like 30 years. Only they had planted some trees. There were no sidewalks, no paths. No one could go in because there was nothing. There was not a garbage bin, there was not a bench, there was nothing on it. And in 30 months, we went from this to this. This is a 13-hectare lake. We were having a concert there. We built sidewalks all over the place, separating side for pedestrians and cyclists, and like 10 of these children's playgrounds. And we were doing concerts. And you know, you gotta do things. When we started doing concerts, we didn't even know how to do it. You know, can you imagine if you fainted and you were right here? It took like 20 minutes to carry you over. But then we brought them Def Leppard for a concert, and they sent their security people 2 weeks in advance. And they said, oh, no, you got to build a grid of corridors so that people can go in and out and whatever. So we learned. We did a wave pool. And here, you know, we did with a library. The Commissioner of Education needed to do a library. We needed a park, so we partnered on that. And also in a park of that size, we also did some active recreation, track and field, velodrome, inline skating. And when we were going to open it to the public, we created a summer festival where we brought in activities that usually would not take place on public parks, such as water skiing championships and kites, and we did concerts and all kinds of crazy things. The kite festival, now it's on the 11th session, the kite festival, where 150,000 people seeing kite flyers from 22 different countries. So those are the kind of things, but it's not, and as you can see, the park is very, very well used. But it's not only the big parks. One of the things that I really like is linear parks, because I love all kinds of parks, but the reality is that in the parks are very homogeneous, the people that go to the park. But when it's the linear parks connect high-end and low-end, commercial and residential, one ethnicity and another. Like this is one that is 18 miles across the city. So we started in one of the wealthiest areas of the city, and actually we had some flowers that were being sold or whatever, because it was at the high end, and always separating against cyclists and pedestrians and having playgrounds. Every single road is crossed through bridges. The cyclists never have to go out on the roads. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens of these bridges all over the city. Because the idea is that the cyclists must get there much faster than anyone on a car. So that's why we get those bridges all over the place. And here now we're going in an era of middle income, a private golf course. They didn't want us to put the bikeway through there because people were going to see them playing golf. No wonder there are problems. And this is where it ended. This is before it ended, next to the Bogota River, and this is after. Can you imagine these people how their life changed, like in all of these parts, when there is a bikeway all around this water, in some of the poorest areas of the city? And at the time, you know, the Japanese Cooperation Agency were telling everybody in Colombia, you know, since there's some traffic congestion, the solution is to have a second story, and then a third or a fourth story. This was on the front page of the national newspaper. They had these drawings, and people were getting excited. You know, $5 billion into this. Thank God that wasn't done. And instead, you know, when there were other things that were simpler, very difficult, but simpler. Everybody used to park on the sidewalks, you know. So do we have sidewalks for people or for cars? It was before, it was after. You know, the people in the retail, they hired hundreds and hundreds of people to get signatures to impeach the mayor. And actually they got like 300,000 signatures. They needed 600,000, but you know, afterwards now they say, oh, now they're doing extremely well. So now they say, oh, I was not part of the campaign. I was one of the others. But look at this, it's a major difference. This was the previous transportation system. And obviously then in 3 years, in 36 months, the first bus rapid transit BRT was set up. It's called Transmilenio. And in the first year, they were having 600,000 rides. And then it works very well. It's like a subway, but on a bus. And one of the nice things now it carries about 1.4 million people daily. In all of the stations, people can exchange from one to another on the station without having to pay again. And also, there's a very clear link. Like when I went with Clarence and Aaron and Carla, they were asking, why isn't it too expensive to have a bicycle parking for 700 bikes with a private guard? And then the CEO of Transmilenio told them, said, you know, people have to get into the BRT some way. So either we have more feeder buses, we gotta get them on feeder buses, or if it's by car, then we gotta provide parking, or it's a lot cheaper if they go on their bikes. So this is a more inexpensive solution than any of the others, so making the link. And then also in 3 years, 174 miles were built of separate bikeways, and from less than 0.5%, now it's at over 5% of the bike share, and it's some things were done. But one of the things that I like the most, and I'm glad that the people from Street Films are here, because I took some of these photos when I was there with them. So they know that this is true. We went through a neighborhood where for kilometers was like this, extreme poverty. There were not even sidewalks, there were not even pavement, because they didn't have sewage, so they got to put the sewage first in order to pave. But never in these extreme poverty neighborhoods, some bikeways that would make any city proud anywhere in the world were built. And this transformed the life of many of these people. And I remember when we were doing the video with Street Films, and we were at 8 a.m. at the time when people were bringing in their kids. Oh, look at that. Look at the face of this girl. You know, this is worth, you know, any effort that you make, it's fantastic. Look at this. This is 3-in-1. Okay, and now there have been a lot of studies, such as these people from various universities that are doing studies on what is the impact on the city, and they are studying the bicycle networks and whatever, and obviously they increase the areas of the square meters of green spaces, and also the Transmilenio, the 70 kilometers, and the bikeway, the bike paths, and the ciclovia. And so they've been studying how people are more physically active. The people in Bogota now are 50% more physically active than in other similar cities of Latin America. The people that use Transmilenio increases by 70% the probability of walking. And look at this other statistic, homicides. Homicides per 100,000. When all of a sudden you got fantastic, or not fantastic, but very, pretty good public places, then how from 91 to 2006, the homicide rate per 1,000 inhabitants went down radically. And it was nothing major change with the guerrilla or the drugs or whatever. It's a lot of changes take place. And finally, I want to invite you to think outside the box. You know, some people say, what is the definition of insanity? Doing things the same way over and over and over again and expecting different results. You know, people are afraid of thinking outside the box. They say, oh, there goes Jack thinking outside the box. And say, oh, you know, if you think outside the box, maybe you're going to fall on your butt. But there is a lot more going on outside the box. So let's think outside the box. This is Gale Architects that said, you know, almost every city has a city department that is thinking about their buildings. a different city department about traffic, and another city department talking about trees and green spaces. So they said, okay, what do we think more holistic? And think as one, more people-oriented planning. And we got to take hard decisions. In South Korea, you know, they needed to build a highway. And a transportation engineer said, oh, why don't we build it on top of a river? Then we don't have anyone complaining because we're not going to take down any house on top of the river. And then the highway was full. And then when it was full, then they said, why don't we build a second story? So then the second story. And then the second story got full. So now they want to do a third story. Thank God someone didn't do it, and instead they tore it down. And look what it looks like now. People in many places, you know, bold actions, you know, the congestion taxi in London, you know, you gotta do what you gotta do, even if that costs you in the elections afterwards, you know. Livingstone in London announced £500 million, $1 billion, not million with an M, billion with a B, in pipeways over 10 years. Those are the kind of things, you know. Portland, wake up, these are your competitors now. And I'm sure that Portland can compete, you know. Public bikes everywhere. You know, in Paris, in the last 12 months, what Paris has done with the bikes is fantastic. They have created, they have 20,400 bikes everywhere in Paris. You get one of these stations anywhere in Paris within 200 meters, which is, whatever, like 150 yards. With 150 yards of anywhere in Paris, you'll find a bike station. And then you use the bike stations. And they still don't have all the best facilities, but they're improving. What the mayor said is, he built a lot of really nice facilities, but he knows it's not 100%, but he said, if we get hundreds of thousands of people using the bikes, then they're gonna pressure the city into improving the quality. So they are building a lot of facilities all over the place. And it is quite nice, and this is how it works, and you go to any place. If you use it for half an hour less, it's free. Anywhere in Paris. This is the most fantastic, you know. I was there in November when they had a transit strike, and wow, you know, they got like 350,000 users daily. This is a boulevard in Paris. 3 years ago, this boulevard had 8 lanes and was packed with cars. And the car owners wanted 12 lanes instead of 8. What did the mayor do? He reduced from 8 to 4 in the last 3 years. He put wide sidewalks, he put a separate bikeways, and he put a train in the middle. You know? And the train in the middle has grass, so when the train is not going by, the look and feel is the look and feel of a park. So this is the kind of things. Obviously, it was hard. Obviously, it was difficult, because some people say, oh, yeah, it's so easy. No. Always the grass is greener in the next door neighbor, right? Yeah, no, it's... It was gutsy, and look at this. Can you imagine the people that live on this boulevard, how their quality of life improved so much? It was amazing. So this is the city hall in Paris, and the bike system, the relief, which is quite nice. People of all ages, and genders, and whatever. And actually, this board, they got 20 different repair shops. This is one of the repair shops that goes along the River Seine. And it's going up and down, and they got 6 mechanics working full-time on repairing bikes. At any time, 15% of the bikes at any time are being repaired, because each bike has 11 uses per day of 11 different people. Can you imagine? And now I want to end with Copenhagen. I know that people sometimes they tell me, oh, Gil, Copenhagen, we are in North America, not in Europe. But I love Copenhagen. I think we can learn a lot about Copenhagen. First, Copenhagen is very similar to Portland or to the U.S. It has it has very similar per capita income, educational levels, political system. It has warm summers, cold winters, snow, ice, wind. So it's very interesting. It's actually closer to the North Pole than any place in the U.S., except Alaska. And I'm going to tell you a couple of things about this from a friend of mine, Jan Gehl, who's the owner of Gehl Architects. The other day he sent me these photos, and he said he was celebrating his 45th anniversary. And what he did to celebrate his 45th anniversary is he went on a bike ride with his wife. And he said, you know, isn't it fantastic when two people that combined have 136 years and can go on a 21-kilometer bike ride, totally relaxed, without ever thinking that they were in any kind of danger. He said it must be a nice city. And actually, his mother is this one, age 92, she still bikes. And his mother-in-law is 85, and she still bikes. So those are the kind of things that make it worth it. You know, when important, when they started talking that they were going to make some pedestrian streets, and I really like that Mia mentioned that a lot of cities in Europe are creating car-free areas. You know, in the last 30 years, over 1,000 municipalities in Europe have created a car-free area. So it wasn't that they were built like that 300 years ago. No, in the last 30 years. You know, when in Copenhagen, about 35 years ago, they were going to make their first pedestrian street. People, you know, they said, oh, no, here it's not possible. He said, here, we love cars. We have too many cars. You know, the weather is terrible. But mostly, it's not part of our culture. They said, oh, you know, being on the street, that's for the Italians. You know, because the Italians are loud and are noisy and like to party. But, you know, we're from Denmark. We stay indoors. We don't go out. We are serious. Well, you know, they were wrong. The Danish now are more Italian than the Italians. Look at this. And they built one and was very successful. And then the next, and the next. And the most expensive commercial areas in Copenhagen are in the pedestrian streets. This is City Hall in Copenhagen. You know, bicycle, when they tell you that people have always bike, you know, in Copenhagen, cycling was going down in the 1970s. Under 10% of the people used to bike in Copenhagen. But then they had the oil crisis of the 70s. And then it was very, very hard all over Europe. And in Denmark, they said, we will never depend on oil again. So they started promoting solar energy, wind power, all kinds of bicycles. And in the last 15 years, bike cycling has doubled in Copenhagen. And actually, this is what we need, you know, children and women and seniors. And look at this chart. This is the people going into the city. This is 1970. When people that tell you that it's always been like that, look at this, how it's grown. Look in year 2000 to 2005. You know, the inner city. Now more people are going in than by cars or trucks or any way. So don't believe when they say, oh, no, you know, we cannot learn anything from Copenhagen. Don't even talk about Copenhagen. Those are the fundamentals that Andy was talking about. We can learn from everybody, you know. But did all of this happen? Because actually, sometimes when I go to Denmark, the people in Canada tell me, hey, Gil, why don't you see what is it that those people in Denmark, what do they have for breakfast? Because they are so different, they are so strange, that they must be eating something different. Not really, you know. What did they do? People have been out on their bikes protesting. In the 1970s and 1980s, this was what cycling looked like in Copenhagen. Critical mass, yeah, similar to critical mass. People, hundreds, thousands and thousands of people were protesting everywhere. At the parliament, at the public meetings, everywhere. So it wasn't easy here. And today, 4 out of every 5 people in Copenhagen use their bike as their mode of transportation. Day and night, weekday and weekends. It's fantastic. And the mayor just came out. Listen, Portland, and challenge the residents that by 2015, over 50% should be the bike share. Now it's at 40%, they want to go over 50%. So they are doing all kinds of many of the things that you were talking about on working the schools, in the hospitals, in the businesses, or whatever. So, you know, now is where we want to see Portland playing. We want to see Portland in the World Cup of the best cycling cities in the world. And this is one of the competitors. Look at this, 70% continue to bike all winter when there is snow, but then separate, the pedestrians, the cyclists, the cars. Look, and you don't have important this kind of weather. So if you don't do better than them, even they go with their mink coats. Cycling, when cycle doubles, then you get traffic congestion, you know. So you got a traffic light, but what a nice problem to have. So now they got more paths and more routes, and they want to increase them, and they're building more. And so they're going through all of these challenges, you know. But this is part of changing the city culture. You know? There is a lot more to walking than walking, and I think this is some of the magic that Portland has. You know, it's places. You know, we're gonna go from places for cars to places for people. You know, over the last 80 years, we've been building cities more thinking on cars mobility than on children's happiness. And those two concepts are not compatible. So we gotta do things in a different way. And they said, you know, what happens if it rains? Well, even on rainy days, the pedestrian streets are very popular. And you know, when they tell you it's going to rain, don't worry. You just ride with your umbrella. And you put your plastic boots. And then it rains. And it's not the end of the world. People keep riding. You know, even in their miniskirts. And the other day I was in León, a city in Mexico, where they have a lot of shoe factory. And I said, don't worry. If cycling improves, it's not going to be because people are in spandex and cleats. The Danish, they don't wear any cleats. They wear regular shoes. Even the ones they use to kick their boyfriends when they don't behave, which is this one. So this is what we need. Everyday people riding bikes everywhere. And outdoor cafes all year round. And then, you know, can you imagine for the economy of this city? Here, there were 90 cars parking. A parking, what even would be best for the quality of life in the city? 90 cars parked there? Or this. Get rid of those 90 cars, and you know, those are the kind of things. But don't think that the retail was very happy at the beginning. Now they're extremely happy. Always there is resistance. When you're doing change, you cannot do change by consensus. You have to listen. But when you're going to do change by consensus, you gotta lower the standard so much that then the change is insignificant.
That's the point.
You have to listen, because always there will be people opposed to change. So it doesn't mean that you don't listen to the people, honestly listen to the people, but consensus is not how it works. So we're going to do some of these things all seasons. And it's not only about the big cities. You know, Copenhagen is about the size of Portland, but there are also many, many small Danish towns, such as this one of 55,000, that are doing similar pedestrian streets, or this one, 63,000, and they're promoting cycling and walking and human-oriented cities. So anywhere in North America, we can look at some of this. Okay, so in conclusion, we have some challenges ahead of us, but we also have magnificent opportunities. What kind of cities are we going to build, and how do we want to live? It's not about the money. It is about priorities, but it's not about the money. It is not a technical issue. Somewhere in the world, people are doing what we have, or else we have the creativity, such as that fantastic bikeway that we saw the photo on the or the video, or that is here in Portland, the floating bikeway, which is fantastic. So it's not a technical issue either. But then how do we move from thinking and saying to doing? We need leadership. And leadership can come from many places. Different cities, it comes from different places. Some cities like Vancouver is more of the city staff. Other places are the politicians. Other places are the critical mass. Other places are the students. So, but there has to be leadership. Number two, political will. Politicians need to have guts, you know, because they gotta have clarity that the general interest must prevail over the particular one. So we need political will. Number three, we need doers in the public sector. We need people that 24/7 are thinking on solutions to the problems and not on problems to the solutions. I was in the public sector. We don't get paid in the public sector for finding 20 reasons why things cannot be done. But we get paid is to get things done. So we need doers in the public sector. And we need community engagement. And that's when I think of Jessica, Robert, Sabalta, and saying, if you are not writing the letters, you are allowing someone else to write them and set the agenda. So we have to be engaged. We have to participate. We got to go to the public meetings. We got to write in the newspapers. We got to make our voices. You know, pedestrians and cyclists seem to be transparent, seem to be invisible. We have to become visible. And the last one is we need a sense of urgency. We need action. We said not only do we have to improve the cities that we have today, but we got to build cities for 100 million additional people in the next 35 years. So we need an attitude almost of ready, fire, aim. And not ready, aim, and never fire. So, the ducks are in a row. It's about doing things right. But much more important than doing things right is about doing the right things. So, the opportunity for Portland and for every city, that wherever you're coming from, whether it's from Mexico, we got a fantastic delegation from Mexico, or from Canada, from anywhere in the world, you got to have a shared vision. Where is it that you want to go? Where do you want this city to be 10, 20, 30 years from now? And this has to be a shared vision by many people of the community. But if you only have the vision and you don't work at it, it's like daydreaming. And then you gotta work. You gotta work and work and work. But if you work a lot but you don't know where you're going, then it's not daydreaming, but it's like a nightmare. But if you have a fantastic shared vision and you collectively work at it, you can transform Portland and then Oregon and then the U.S. and then the world. So the stars are aligned. I wish you all the best and thank you very much.
This podcast is brought to you by the extra batteries found by Joe Carroll. Well, I hope you enjoyed that keynote speech by Gil Peñalosa. Immediately after the speech, I managed to worm my way into the press conference where we got to ask some more questions of Gil. And also present was Andy Clark of the League of American Bicyclists. The first question was asked by Steve Jones of the San Francisco Bay Guardian.
No question. In San Francisco, we're going to be doing our first Ciclovia in August. And I've heard discussions about whether the route that was chosen, which is an Embarcadero route kind of on the edges of the city that already has good bike lanes and already is kind of a multimodal area, whether that's a good choice or whether a route that is more kind of traffic heavy and cuts the city more might have been better. I was wondering whether you could talk a little bit about what's the sort of ideal route or parts of town for a Ciclovia.
How many days are they doing it?
3 days in August.
Okay. Well, first, I think it's good to do it 3 days.
Okay.
Or four. I think that I hope that Sunday is going to be spectacular and very successful. But all the cities, I suggest to do it 3 or 4 days. Okay. Because the first day is when you have all of the problems. All of them. Even if you already have an established Sunday bike way, right, and you add a few kilometers, on the first Sunday, there's always problems. Because then the priests and the pastors, all the religious denominations, they complain that people couldn't get to the service on time. Mm-hmm. And someone doesn't like his mother-in-law and then doesn't go to her birthday lunch and say, oh, it's because I couldn't get there. Mm-hmm. So everybody has complaints on the first Sunday. Mm-hmm. The second Sunday, people know how to go another way around. So they get there. Mm-hmm. The third, people love it. And by the fourth, they want to do it all year round. Mm-hmm. So by the when you end it either on the third or the fourth Sunday, people want a lot more. And mm-hmm. I think that's where you have to end it. So I think that's really good. The second thing is that this is totally different than a bikeway, than a path. Mm-hmm. It's almost something kind of like forbidden. All of the sudden, people like to go to the Sunday bikeways because, like, some people say, oh, but if you're building parks, maybe we don't need the Sunday bikeways anymore. No, it has nothing to do with the parks, mm-hmm. and it has nothing to do with the trails. It's something different. It's a gathering. People want to go and see other people. And also, the roads are big enough for people to do many things. So you see people walking or cycling or doing jazz or doing aerobics or doing... obviously, whatever there is higher densities, the better. Mm-hmm. It will work better. I think the one in New York on Park Avenue is going to be fantastic. Fantastic. Mm. 3 weeks in a row on Park Avenue. Baltimore is going to do it too. Baltimore announced for this October, but now they just postponed for April because of budget. But they have the budget reserved, and the city is going to pay for the one in Baltimore in April of next year. And this is a different way of looking at the city. I think what is really fantastic is that this is almost an exercise in civility. And that's why this is important. This is where... Well, the wealthiest people of the city meet the least. Let me go back. When I started, when I became crazy about promoting the Ciclovia, mm-hmm. I was thinking of Frederick Olmsted, who designed most of the best urban parks in the U.S. and Canada too. When he was designing Central Park 150 years ago, he was obsessed that in New York everybody hated everybody, the rich and the poor, the immigrants and the locals, the blacks and the whites. And he said they never see each other because they don't live in the same buildings, they don't go to the same schools, they don't go to the same restaurants. So he said we need some public places where people will meet each other as equals. And this is what the Ciclovía en Bogotá does. it allows people to meet each other as equals. I'm sure that many, many millionaires meet their presidents, CEOs of large corporations. It is the only place ever where they meet their minimum wage workers and their families doing the same activity. Mm-hmm. When you know a little bit about bicycles, you know that one that just went by is worth $5,000. Mm-hmm. The other one is $50. But whether it's $5,000 or $50, both are having the same fun. You know, mm-hmm. Some people have an original Nike, other ones have a fake Nike, but both have as much fun. So this is what is important. So, the other thing is that we started extending it because we started doing a lot of research and a lot of surveys. And we found that people would not go if it was more than 15 minutes away from their homes, 10 to 15 minutes. So we had to start extending it because otherwise people would not attend. So that's why it really is better to cover a large area.
Just to complement what Gil was saying, I think it's also important what your question was, either the heavy traffic street.
Yeah.
Well, it also depends on what your message is going to be, no? It's, for example, Mexico City, an important part of the whole program is recuperating public spaces for the city. And this means, you know, having the program in heavy traffic streets. So that could also be interesting.
That's also something that is very important. In Mexico City, they want to send a clear message through that program. They want to promote cycling through that program. Mm. So that's why they even call it moving on bicycles, muévete en bici. So because it was very clear, very deliberate purpose. They were going to do this gigantic investment in 300 miles of bikeways, and then they said, okay, you know, we have to educate and get the community. Other places like in El Paso, Texas, their major issue was obesity. They were having a lot of problems of obesity. So then the way they set up their program last year, 4 Sundays in May, was through creating an physical activity against obesity.
Mm-hmm. In San Francisco, we've already heard the first opposition. It's just been announced recently. And in your speech, you said, we don't want to do this by consensus. We just want to do it. And I wonder if you could expand on that in terms of nuts and bolts politics, how you make that happen.
Well, you know, in New York, a lot of people are against it. But Mayor Bloomberg decided to do it. And he said, okay, we're doing it. There's always opposition to everything. Actually, I call some people the civic cadavers. Cadavers, you say? Yeah, civic cadavers. That they don't do anything for the city. But when you are going to do something, they resuscitate. You know? And then they say, oh, no, we want... And so change is always hard. So people... Like all of the pedestrian streets all over, all the European pedestrian streets, when they started those, everybody was, the retail was very much against it. Afterwards, they're doing very, very well, so now they're very much in favor. So I think that you honestly have to listen to the people, but at the end of the day, you were elected and you got to decide whatever you think is best for the majority. If you want to do something without opposition, then it's impossible to do anything. And the easiest way not to be criticized is to do nothing. If you don't do anything, then you're not criticized. Mm-hmm. But that is also another advice for the people that are organizing these kind of events. It's how to set up the media. The media is the best ally. So you have to go to the media. For example, when they were starting the examples of Guadalajara and Mexico City, first they went to the media. And they said, look, we're going to do this. Please, don't kill the program even before it starts. Allow it to happen. Once it happens, we'll see. If it doesn't work, okay, we eliminate it. Actually, today in the New York Times, that's also what Mayor Bloomberg is saying. He said, we're going to do 3 Saturdays. If it doesn't work, okay, then we don't do it next year. They said, but how many are you going to do next year? He said, I don't know. Let's see how it works. I think that's another advice. It's good always to... People are not as opposed when you come with something on a transitory, when it's not permanent. Mm-hmm. You say, oh, no, let's do it 3 Sundays or 4 or whatever. You say, oh, but are you going to close the road forever? No, it's 4. Then we'll move from there. Maybe mm-hmm. from 4 we go to 10 or 12 or whatever. But if you come very fundamentally, say, no, it has to be always or never. So try to avoid the always or the never because that doesn't make things easier.
What did it do for your brother's legacy as the mayor of Bogota?
What?
the success of the ciclovias? Did
it make them more popular?
Well, I did it before he became mayor, so he got elected. No, not really. No, we're good friends, and we do many things. No, you know, it depends. Change is hard. For example, when he got the cars afterwards, he's the one who got the cars out of the sidewalks. And the retail was very, very much against. It was amazing. There were threats against me, against my mother, against my brothers, against him. It was terrible. And because all the retail saying that they were going to go broke if people could not park on the sidewalks. And the sidewalks were, the cars were totally one against the other, parked in front of the restaurant. And they said they would go broke. And they had the discussion that if people could not park in front, against the door, they would not go to the restaurants or the stores. Because there were no parking places, and then but then the argument is, if you can park in front of the store, you're not going to park in, there's not going to be parking lots. So then it's a catch-22. So you got, once people could not park on the sidewalks, private parking lots started popping up everywhere because it became good business. But before it was, so it was hard. Like when I mentioned that they hired hundreds and hundreds of people to get signatures to impeach him as mayor. So it was tough. So sometimes some of these decisions are difficult. Mayor Livingston just lost the election in London, and he was, I think he was doing a lot of good things. But I think he was doing what he thought was right, not what he thought would get him re-elected. Otherwise, he would not have done congestion tax, or he would not have done the bike program or the pedestrian program or a lot of the public spaces programs.
Does it send a bad message to other big city mayors, though, that you might lose your job if you do something bold like this?
Yes.
How do you overcome that? I mean, how do you...
Well, it depends what you want to do.
How do you keep giving Gavin Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco, courage to follow through on this after watching what happened to Livingston?
No, you know, it's terrible. That's why I don't like it. I don't like re-elections, you know. Mm-hmm. I think re-elections... I think people should be elected maybe twice, have one re-election and maybe two. I mean, whatever you don't do in 12 years, you're not going to do in 24. Mm-hmm. I worked for a little bit in a city in Canada, Mississauga, that the mayor is 84 years old. She's been mayor for 28 years. Mm-hmm. And then she gets reelected, and everybody gets reelected. I think that if there was only one reelection, for example, the mayor in New York, it's only one reelection. The first 4 years you learn. The second 4 years you do as much as you can because you're going to be away. You won't be there for life. But sometimes in the places where there's indefinite reelection, the day after people are reelected, or the same day, all they're thinking is how to get reelected again. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it sends a bad message for the politicians that are there only to stay on. The politicians that want to do things, though, they just got to do whatever they think is right.
In London, with the new administration, how many of the old policies are being continued and how many are being changed? Because it wasn't clear to me whether that was a personal loss or just a shift in the overall political winds that led to the administrative change.
Both. I don't think it's going to be a radical change. I think that Livingston, something that Mayor Livingston did well is he educated a lot of the people on some of these issues. So some issues are not going back. But there is some change. But that's why I also think it's very, very important to have more community engagement. Let me give you an example. A city that I love is Vancouver. Vancouver, in any ranking in the world on quality of cities, and that's another one of the competitors that Portland has now. Vancouver is always in the top five in the world in quality of life. And one of the things that an interesting thing is that it was led by two co-directors of planning. And over 25 years, for example, over 30 years, they did not allow any highway going into the city. And so if you don't have highways going into the city, then you have to develop a good pedestrian and cycling and public transit. About 5 years ago, they did a vision of Vancouver, the 2020 vision that everybody was doing 2020 visions, except that this one was very different because they did it over 2 years. And they had participated in a workshop, one out of every five residents of Vancouver. It was massive. They went to every school, hospital, business, everywhere. And then one day I was talking to one of them and I said, you know, it doesn't make any sense. Why did you spend so much time and money, 2 years? And then they told me, you know, girl, it was not about the vision. we could have gone, the two of us and a team of three or four other people, to a cottage for a week, and we would have come up with a better vision, with as good or better. He said, no, it was about educating, raising the awareness of many issues. And he said, before that massive community engagement, when there was a public meeting about sidewalks or bikeways or parks or plazas or public transit or whatever, the city staff would have to go and do the fight and whatever. He said, now the city staff stands in the back, and it's the residents themselves that own the issues. So now it doesn't really matter who the next mayor is or who the next council or who the next director of planning, but they were successful in raising the awareness. So I think in some of those issues is why it's very important to have extensive community engagement.
I'm from Victoria, D.C., so I'm trying not to say anything derogatory about Vancouver. But one of your mantras was making bicycling normal and talking about if you're eight or 80 years old, you should feel safe. So what would be the best way? A lot of those, that age group, lives in, let's say, Surrey. So how do you get those people in Surrey to get on their bikes? It's not a city. Getting Surrey to do a ciclovia is going to be very difficult. What's the easiest way to get those people out of their cars?
Well, I think almost everywhere people will get out of their cars if there are safe facilities. Let me tell you, we did with Green Communities Canada, we did a survey the other day in Ontario with school children, and only like 91% of the kids have bikes, but only like 5 or 6% ride into school. So we did a survey. We said, would you ride your bike to school if there were safe facilities? And we were afraid that maybe most of them would not want to. And 48% said they would. It's their parents, the ones that are not allowing them to ride their bikes, because their parents think that it's not safe. So I think that that as long as there are safe facilities, I do think that safe facilities is very, very, very important. I think that I totally agree with Andy, and I think Andy has a very, very difficult job, because within his board of directors, there are people that are very pro-bike lanes, others pro-separate. Well, so I come to the conclusion, I said, let's not fight about one or the other. Would you send your 80-year-old and the 80-year-old great-grandparent on it? If you would, it's safe. It's not, so it's not always. There are some roads that are small enough, so maybe you don't even need bike lanes. You need is bike boulevards. You need road diets, and you need round points, and you need to interrupt the traffic. On the boulevards, you do need separate facilities. I've seen city after city after city across the U.S. and Canada where on a six-lane boulevard, three lanes each way, where people are going at 40 miles per hour, very well-intentioned advocates, after years of advocating, they get a bike lane. And they used to have 100 people on that arterial, and now they have 150, when they thought they were going to have 1,000. And then it becomes counterproductive, because now the politicians say, you see, I told you we were not a cycling culture. It's not part of our culture. So then on those arterials, people will not bike if all you have in between you and an SUV at 40 or 50 miles per hour is a painted line. So I do think that places like Surrey need that. But also, it has to have a complete program. Education plays a major role. Look, the kids, for example, the kids in Holland, since they are born, they're on a bike. You see these little babies on the basket, and they're maybe 3 months old. Nevertheless, every kid in Holland, when they're in third or fourth grade, they have to go to a three-week training session on how to be a pedestrian and a cyclist. You know, we assume that kids must know how to be pedestrians. You know, all the signal and all the roads and everything is done for the cars, not for the people. Why would they know how to be a pedestrian? So how do they know how to cross the streets? So they are being taught for 3 weeks, and they bring these sets of bicycles and signals and everything, so that the kids know how to ride their bikes, even though everybody bikes. So can you imagine in places like Surrey or like most North American cities where they don't have that culture? The education is even more important. So I think we need a lot of all of those things. Unfortunately, it's not one big thing, but it's hundreds of little things. A few big things such as the big infrastructure, but there's 100 little things, and I do believe that education is a critical point, and also education and promotion, whatever. we knew even on the Sunday bike way in Bogota in the Ciclovia, we had a really nice, a wonderful jingle that we played on the radio. And when we had very intensive radio coverage, we would get 300,000 more people coming out. You know, everybody knows that Pepsi and Coke exist, but if you don't see the advertisement, people don't go. So sometimes some of these cultural changes is almost like a social marketing. So you can approach all of this also as part of social marketing, because it's a different way of living. It's about the cultural change.
A question for Andy. Are there any initiatives in the League of American Bicyclists to promote education for children under age 8?
Yeah, we have an instructor program that certifies people to teach bike education in the schools for adults as well. We've got over 1,100, almost 1,200 certified instructors.
Anything in
we've
the school system?
Curriculum for kids and for a Safe Routes to School program. Yeah. That's specifically tailored for kids. So yeah, we've got the materials, we've got the instructors. What they tell us is that they're having a hard time finding time in the curriculum in the schools to get even 3 hours, let alone 3 weeks in the school curriculum is pretty tough. So again, it's not for lack of technical expertise, it's not for lack of money, not for lack of people out there wanting to teach it. It's the kind of commitment or the willingness that the school system has, that our politicians have, to actually get that information out there and use what's there and get it taught.
Maybe Diana can compliment, because Diana from Mexico, she called me the other day and said, oh, you know, education is so critical. It's not only about building bikeways. So what are your thoughts?
Well,
after you told me what not to do, and I'll tell them what it is.
I think that in Mexico City right now, the government's going to invest a huge amount in bikeway infrastructure. But if you do not teach people, 50% of deaths, traffic accidents, are pedestrians and cyclists in Mexico City, and I think that's probably the average for the country as well. And if you do not teach, and when you ask those pedestrians that survive some kind of accident, whether they knew how to read some of the, you know, traffic signs, they do not. So, it's a very, very important aspect of traffic safety to teach people how to read the city. And, you know, design is extremely important in that sense. You know, the more invisible and easy to understand, even if you do not have an education, you know, we have a lot of people coming in, not anymore, but for a long time, you know, rural immigrants coming to the city. And so if the city's not legible to them, then, you know, that's going to be very problematic and cause a lot of accidents. But on top of that, you know, people that actually do live in the city every day should learn, you know, every single user of the road and, you know, basic urban infrastructure should be trained to be able to use the city and use it in a safe way for everybody. So complementing, you know, we're having ideas of, for example, creating this kind of like, schools to become an urban cyclist in Mexico City. And at the end of the training, whether it be, we don't know, you know, if it's like a short training or something that's like for a couple of weeks, at the end of the training, the government or some kind of sponsor gives that person a bicycle and a helmet and, you know, some kind of, you know, just a statement saying, okay, we're not only giving you infrastructure to ride your bikes, which would be sort of like having a what do you call, una andadera?
A walker.
You know, bikeways in a way are kind of like walkers helping people get out there and do this stuff. But if you do not train them how to watch out for cars or motorists, how to watch out for bicycles at the end of this lane or bikeway, then you're just throwing them to the mouths of wolves. So it's very important to teach everybody how to, you know, behave and coexist in an urban environment.
And maybe Tanya could also tell you a little bit what does it mean to Mexico City to have this program under the Secretary of the Environment? what are the expectations? Because one day I was with Tanya and her boss, and I was very impressed of what she said, that this bench. She said, you know, it's difficult, but so much, but nevertheless, so much easier to teach people to separate things, what is recycled and what is not, but to teach people how to bike. So tell us about how do you see the program in Mexico? What are your goals? What are the objectives? Why is it important to the city and to Marcelo Ebrard and his team?
Well, principally, the mayor of Mexico City, as we all know, one of the most important aspects is political support. And for Mexico City and this new administration, the quality of life means making friendlier cities. And making friendlier cities means having a better pedestrian program, having an intermodal transport system where you can really combine public transport and a friendly transport like the bicycle. And I think that's one of the key points within the whole program, elevating the quality of life and making it a better and friendlier city. And I think that is very, very important. So I think that's one of the key points of the program. No? And that's why there is so much investment in public transport and in this non-motorized program. And that means not only infrastructure, but also the ciclovías, which is a totally social program, and, you know, all the benefits that this means.
And I think it's good for everybody to learn from everybody. I think the League of American Cyclists has some fantastic programs. For example, the program on the most business friendly. It's very, very important, because even the businesses that do not compete, they start thinking about what are the elements. Sometimes the workers, they want to tell their bosses to improve the facilities, but they don't know what to ask. But when you say, oh, you know, a bike-friendly business is one that maybe has flexible hours so that people can come in on daylight and leave at daylight, that have safe bicycle parking, that have lockers, that have showers, that maybe has funding for the bike. And then all of a sudden you start changing. So I think many of the fantastic programs that the League is doing is good to teach other, to provide that assistance to cities outside of the U.S., recognition of the cities. It's so important to provide a program like that, but also to be able to have indicators that are objective, and that is not always because he likes this one or because he does. No, that so copy it. And I've told a lot of people in different countries of the world. I said, look, if you want to learn about indicators and how to create a healthy competition. Because actually, in Mexico City, with the Center of Sustainable Transportation, they are doing a contest on the best cities or things that cities have done great. And I said, no, that doesn't work very well, because there is one winner and 10 losers. I said, take a look. So I sent them the link to the League of American Cyclists. I said, this is fantastic, because there can be many winners. At the end of the day, there are no losers, because even the ones that fall short, they know why they fell short of the goal. They also know that they can accomplish it the following year, and they also know that they were not competing against another one. It's against themselves. So programs like that, I think, are very successful and are helping the cities understand what can make them more bicycle-friendly. And actually, now I'm starting a program in Canada with the Minister of Health Promotion on walkable communities. And Andy doesn't know yet, but we're going to ask him for advice. On the same program that he has for how to make the best cycling cities, is how to have the best pedestrian cities, so that this we can make it an objective, and actually we can share it. It can be done in Canada, but in the U.S. and anywhere. And I think that the League is doing great, great things in those.
Well, thank you. And we've seen a huge change in the last just in the last 6 months, probably. From having to do a sales job in cities to pitch the program and to tell them why they need to be more bicycle friendly, now they just want to know what they have to do. They don't need to be persuaded anymore. They want to know where to score points, how to fill out the application form, which questions score most points, just so they can work towards a specific goal, and they can be given literally the bike map or road map of what they need to do. And the art of persuasion, we don't need that so much anymore.
It was encouraging to see some of the success stories, not only Portland, but my own city, New York, making a few baby steps there. Maybe not up at the NCAA level, as you described, Portland, but maybe a decent little league team. But I wonder about some of the hard case American cities, places where the infrastructure for public transit is minimal or non-existent, where there's a strong belief system equating the personal car with personal freedom, and where there's very little experience of the kind of progressive leadership we see in Portland or, to some degree, New York. What would you recommend for difficult cities, the Houstons, the
LA,
Detroit, Dallas, Columbus, where I was born, where they still need to have passenger rail?
Well, I think those cities, I think every city has possibilities. I think that it's about a survival. It's about survival. You know, the reality is that those cities, if they don't become better, the best people are going to leave. Anyone that has a possibility to leave will leave. That's one of the things. In an ever more globalized world, whether you are a carpenter or an artist or an economist or a medical doctor, where do you want to live? If you can live anywhere in the world, why would you live in Houston or in Portland or whatever? So you have to decide. So either they get better, because you have to attract and also retain those people. Because just through monetary incentives, maybe you can get a few people to come here 2-3 years, they make a little bit of money, and as soon as they can, they leave and they go somewhere else. So this is really about survival of those cities. So I think it's important to do some of those things. The other thing is that I think that the poorer that the city is, the better that they need these facilities. The poor people are the ones that need to better public spaces, and they are more animated, and there are more programs and more activities and so on. So I think that it's that there is absolutely no contradiction, and I think that they're going to have to make some major changes. But of course, part of it is having a different vision of what that city is going to be, and to realize that if, but I was at a think tank last week in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan, and the CEO of Ford was there, and he was saying that he tells his company that they are no longer in the automotive business, but in the mobility business, and he was saying that things are going to change radically. And he was saying that the fact that and it was very interesting, he was saying that about between 15% and 20% of the personal income of people is going into transportation. And he said it just doesn't make a lot of sense that someone can spend 20% of the income to use a car for 20 minutes one way, for 40 minutes a day, when the car is going to be standing someplace for 23 hours and 20 minutes, when they could do something else. And it could be like an automatic increase of salary of 10 or 15% if all of a sudden they could share cars. So he said that the way people perceive cars today is going to be very, very different in the future. And I think that if a car manufacturer is saying it, it's maybe because they're starting to see some light. For example, this fantastic program that Paris has, again, leadership, that the mayor of Paris has on the bikes, 20,400 bikes. And they have it in 1,400 bike stations. All of this, and he said, you know, why don't we do this with cars? And then, so he's going to do it, but he's going to take a zero out of each one. So instead of having 20,000 cars, he's going to have 2,000 cars. And instead of having 1,400 stations, he's going to have 140 stations. So they are working on setting up the same program, but for cars. And then this is going to revolutionize things. And some cities are changing. Vancouver. In Vancouver now, and I know you don't like Vancouver, Victoria's beautiful too. And it's more bike friendly and it's more pedestrian friendly, I agree. But it's also smaller, so sometimes it's easier. But in Vancouver today, if you're going to have a building, an office building, more than any office building has to have indoor bicycle parking. If it's more than 5 stories tall, has to have lockers and showers. So all of this, and the other thing, if it's more than 8 story, it has to have community cars, community-owned cars. So then maybe if you were going to have 2 cars, you say, oh, the community owns a car, maybe I need only one. Or even if you were going to have 1, maybe you say, oh, I'm going to try how it works without any. And then they are forcing the buildings, and they say, okay, if you don't want to build as many parking spaces, that's fine. But instead, you got to have community-owned cars. So I think that a lot of cities are changing the way cities are doing things. And
we've been working in Flint in Michigan, which is home to General Motors. And kind of the same story, although it's not GM that's woken up to this yet. The city of Flint wants to become the health and wellness center for North America. They want people to travel to Flint to discover how to revitalize, how to save their population, how to save their city with health and wellness initiatives. They want to do it through the University of Michigan, through some other technical colleges they've got there. Their vision is to reinvent the city from being the vehicle city to being the health and wellness center. And the great news is they got two really good things going for them. Number one, they got all the space you can imagine on the streets and highways because they're not busy. So they can really rebuild their city. They can reallocate space. They can really create some of those great streets that Gil was showing. And the second thing they have that they haven't realized has always been there is the Flint River. And the Flint River Trail is this incredible resource. It's got kind of a slightly crappy trail along it right now, but it's a trail you can ride on. And there's a Friends of the Flint River Trail group that twice a week from May through October takes people on bike rides along the Flint River. And they literally open people's eyes on that trail. The ride is never more than, their longest ride is 19 miles, and there's ice cream at the end of it. Most of their rides are about 6 or 8 miles along the Flint River Trail. And people have no idea that resource is there in their backyards. And all of the people that we've met who are helping to kind of save Flint and rebuild Flint and recreate it, they've all graduated from these rides that the Friends of the Flint River Trail have put on. Every community has got that kind of asset or that kind of opportunity to kind of start rebuilding on, whether it's Columbus or Dayton or Flint or Cincinnati or some of the other kind of tougher cities that are out there. Kansas City, Missouri, the mayor just announced he's going to go for platinum in the VFC program. People were shocked. They're not even on the radar at bronze. You know, they've got a long, long ways to go. But that's kind of his vision. And as soon as he said it, 9 mayors from Kansas City, Missouri, across to Shawnee, Kansas, have agreed to kind of sign up to do a regional bicycle-friendly community initiative to link the communities together. And Shawnee is one of those places that is of bronze already. And one reason is that they listened to their public. They did some surveys in the Park and Recreation Department, community surveys, and they asked, what's important to you? What do you want in your community? And they were shocked to discover that it was trails and it was being able to ride a bike and go for a walk. And they have been able to use that. Every 5 years, they ask the population the same question. And for 15 years, it's been, you know, that's been top of the list of things that people want in Shawnee, Kansas. You know, it's not Boulder. That's not Madison. It's not Portland. So there's, in every community, there's somewhere to start. There's a facility or an opportunity or a resource or some people that are that you can use to get started and get things moving.
Yeah, I think that I'm going to have to leave because I have a meeting with the people from Guadalajara and Alta, because Alta Planning might be doing some work in Mexico City and some work in Guadalajara. And actually, it's going to be nice because it's two different teams of people. So it will be nice because even within Alta, might be competing teams to see who does it better. But look at Pittsburgh. The Pittsburgh Steelers. Now there is not even a steel mill in Pittsburgh. So it was a city that used to be totally... the image of Pittsburgh was that it was an ugly city, industrial, full of steel factories. Now it's a city full of parks and trails, and it's clean, and it's... You say, wow, when did this happen? Well, it happened over a very short period of time, 15, 20 years. But it's totally transformed. If anybody had gone to Pittsburgh 20 years ago and goes today, doesn't even recognize that it's in the same city. So there are examples that are taking place. But nevertheless, I think that it will be very important that people also realize that we need major steps. Major steps. That's why I started talking about the baby steps. Because now everybody's doing something. I mean, it's fashionable and it's good, but it's not just baby steps. We gotta do major leaps. There is a huge crisis in everything, whether you take the environment of the public health or the economic competitiveness or whatever, it's huge economic huge crisis in everywhere. So we have to change the way we live, and it will take some gutsy politicians, and it will be nice to have cities. That's why I also said that Portland, if Portland is successful, I mean, Portland has 5% bike share. That's nothing. We want Portland with 20%. Can you imagine the day that a city in the U.S. with over 1 million people has 20% bike share and maybe another 20% walk share? So that we got 40% or 45 or 50% between walking and... It would be such a role model that it would be great. So my wish for Portland is that they don't become complacent, because now they are at the highest award and we're already too good and we're great and me and my friends, all of us bike. But that they say, okay, now that this is fantastic, now we're going to work with the league, because now we're going to go to the major leagues. We were at little leagues, now we're going to be with the big players. That would be so fantastic to have a successful Portland. And the last thing is, in all of the surveys, people, when you look at the surveys, and city after city that I've seen in Canada and in the U.S., the number one physical activity is walking, by far. And when you ask people what kind of facilities do they want, trails and bikeways, but they don't get them. They don't get them because the pedestrians and the cyclists seems to be invisible. That's why I think it's so important when I mentioned that you need the five things: the leadership, the political will, the doers in the public sector, community engagement, and a sense of urgency. The community engagement is critical, because usually the pedestrians and the cyclists are not organized. The other day I was in a city in Canada, and they were presenting the results of a master plan, of Paris master plan, to the city council. And it was fantastic. Everything was walking and cycling and trails and biking. I said, wow, finally they got it. The last 10 minutes of their presentation, whoops, the financial recommendations, totally opposite. They wanted arenas and gymnasiums and whatever. So then I stood up and I said, you know, mayor and councilors, I think that the consultant is very good and whatever, but maybe last night they were doing a cut and paste at midnight, and they were too tired, and they pasted the wrong recommendations. Because we just heard for 80% of the presentation something that was totally different than the 20% of the financial issues. And then I started thinking, why does this happen community after community? And when you take a look at that community, they did a household survey. And I really believe in household surveys, because if it's done well, it's the voice of the residents. Because when you do a household survey, you listen to everybody, users and no users, rich and poor and young and old and everybody. Instead, when you do a public meeting, only the very engaged actually go. And I said, why is it that in that city, the household survey requested the same bike with the same trail, the same pedestrian, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 10, 5, every 5 years they do the household survey. And then it's just that they're not organized. So the people that want the arenas, they're organized. So then they send letters to the councilors or emails. They make the phone calls. They send letters to the papers. So then the city council approved over $1,000 per household on arenas. When they had asked the people on the household survey, where should the city invest more? And they gave me like 25 different things. Arenas came out in 16th. But when the allocation of resources came, it was number one, because they're organized. So one of the things we need to do with pedestrian and cycling people is to get organized. You know, if people go to use a facility in the city, a soccer field, and it's not in good condition, that night the councilor gets letters and emails and phone calls and whatever. A pedestrian goes and the sidewalk has a crack, and then you just jump over it. And 3 days later, you don't even notice. You unconsciously, you jump over the crack. So I think that it's that we need the more advocacy groups. I think that that's something that maybe the League of American Cyclists can create an award. And how to promote advocacy groups, because that's absolutely critical. And we have to help the advocacy groups, because sometimes it's going to be a nurse or a dentist or a lawyer or a carpenter or something that has no idea how to organize. They want to do something. They even want to have the will to provide some time to organize a group, but they need someone to help them, to teach them how to crawl and then how to walk. And then when they're running, then they can let them go on their own. But initially, it's very, very expensive to learn how to set up the not-for-profit and how to get it organized and how to get the policies and the regulations and the meetings and the minutes and the legal issues. And that this dentist that wanted to create an advocacy on walkable or bikeable community, oh, I don't have the time for that. It's easy just to send a check of $20 to the League of American Cyclists. Yeah. So we somehow we need to promote local advocacy groups. Well, I'm really sorry I have to leave you all right. And
thank
everybody.
You.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for a record-setting two-hour Bikescape. So I'm going to end it here. I would like to tell you that you can reach me at bikescape@sbcglobal.net. You can see the show, the blog, show notes in the blog, all the links to everything you've heard in the show, as well as archive shows from earlier at www.bikescape.blogspot.com. And new, there's you can now leave audio messages that can be used in the show if you like. Or you can just leave an audio message for me. The number is, if you're outside the United States, country code 01, area code 206-984-1216. Just leave a message. It'll go in the show. So with that, I would like to remind you that when you're out on the road, day or night, morning or evening, don't forget to take the lane. Bye now.
Rest in your chest cavity. We ask God to bless these festivities. Yet this hostility felt between you and me stops. Opportunity given to spread unity. Tuna be rhythmically wiping sadness clear. Reggae cumbia mixtures create this atmosphere. People packing cheers simply cause these songs show death. Giving shouts to these victims of wrongful death. Now, soon as we're rid of society, small terrors, the sooner these teenagers don't have to be pallbearers and carry their vows nearer to graves. Premature, they cure. Mature by keeping your hearts.